Okay. Actually, the introduction was kind of taking a different route than the one I was meaning to take. Whenever I go to a talk, usually which has such a title, I expect at the end of the day some like charges, who they actually still know something about Coulomb's law, would attract each other, and it often ends up to be disappointing because the charges are going to be decorated and dressed, and the system is going to be so complicated that at the end of the day you don't really feel these charges are following Coulomb's law anymore. So the fact that they attract may be not that intriguing. But hopefully I will try to actually give a kind of physicist account of this phenomenon and try to construct some arguments for you to actually see some like charges who still know something about Coulomb's law attract each other given the kind of conditions that appears, for example, in natural situations like in DNA case. The kind of system that I will have in mind is, for example, a charge. It could be a planar object, for example, a charged membrane, which is present. It's actually usually the outer boundary of the cell is negatively charged, so it's an object which is of some importance in nature. You can think about a charged polymer, a linear object, and examples of that DNA, actin, which is another stiff polymer, and it's it has a very important functional role. Actually, it forms like acts like a skeleton to the cell, which has dynamical mechanical functionality. It can deform the cell whenever it's necessary. For example, if the cell wants to pass through a narrow pore, it will squeeze the cell, and it's important to know how the changes in the shape of this stiff polymer, for example, takes place. It can be can have a simple point-like geometry, like a spherical colloidal particle, a simple latex bead, or it can be a vesicle made out of these membranes, a closed surface, which may contain some important material that is supposed to deliver at some point, etc. Important length scales in the problem. There's this natural length scale when you compare Coulomb energy to thermal energy, KT, which is called the Beerum length. And actually, given the solvent, which is water, for example, in most interesting cases, epsilon is fixed and T is the room temperature. So this has a simple fixed value for us, which is 7 angstrom for the case of water. And that more or less tells us the length scale at which Coulomb energy becomes comparable or becomes important. Another important length scale is the Debye screening length.
Yeah, this is going astray. I mean, you know, coming from Hartmann's analysis, when your system is non-metal, like a dielectric, right, you would say that the Coulomb interaction at certain equilibrium is an infinite length.
That's true.
Right? So what is the precise meaning then of this?
Okay. Problem? You're thinking about the screening length of electrostatic interaction. This is not the screening of electrostatic interaction, but if you write, you know, beta V, which is, okay, Coulomb interaction divided by KT, it has this form, right? And then there's R in it. Yeah, so when you construct the Boltzmann weight, this is when the Boltzmann weight becomes appreciable. Okay. The other length scale is the Debye screening length when you have some, for example, you have salt in the system. Salt essentially means positive and negative ions, which are mobile, they are free to move, and you can tune the density of it. If you have a density, say, N, the Debye screening length is given by this simple relation, and for example, for physiological conditions, this is fixed to 150 millimolar, which gives you a screening length of about 10 angstrom. And that is again fixed when you're talking about humans, for example. In addition to the so-called macroions in the solution, you need to have the overall neutrality of the system maintained. And to do that, there are mobile ions in the solution which you call counter ions because they have the counter charge to the macroion itself. And an important parameter for the counter ions is the so-called valence, which is simply the number of charges that they carry. And you can denote it by Z. And you can see that this parameter plays a role when you're actually interested in the fluctuations of these ions because they can carry many charges at the same time when they fluctuate thermally. Okay. So the question I'm going to answer, if I want to phrase it in a very clear way, is what is the interaction between two of these, say, macroions, given that they are in a solution of neutralizing counterions because you need it? So already you see there's a degree of reduction in the charge because if you have two negatively charged, say, membranes, there are a lot of positive charges in between, and that changes the picture of simple repulsion between two-point charges in vacuum, which we have in mind. Okay, now let's... the first thing that we need to determine is the behavior of the counterions, given that they are close to the macroions, and there's this tendency that they want to condense on the surface of these macroions to gain a lot of electrostatic energy, attractive energy. And there is, on the other hand, entropy due to thermal motion. They can go away to infinity and gain a lot of entropy. And that's the kind of picture, if you come from chemistry, this actually fills up your mind that there is no way that the counterions can sit down because chemical potential is usually a finite amount of energy gain, and you don't really think about these counterions to be able to condense. So when such a thing happens due to the long range of the interaction, you're actually puzzled, whereas if you come from ground state type of thinking, you say, okay, it's just energy minimization. There's no big deal here. So let's actually see how these factors compete with each other. And you will see that depends very sensitively on the dimensionality of the system. Okay, let me get rid of these. So imagine you have a charged surface. Let's say it has a number charge density of sigma, and you have a counterion of valence Z, which is at a distance r from the plane. You can construct the free energy of this system, say free energy divided by kT. The energy part is the, because there's a constant electric field here, it can simply be written by this linear law, and the coefficient has the density in it, and this is just E squared divided by kT because of beta here, and the valence is obvious why it comes, why it appears. And then there's the entropy. Because the counterion is more or less confined in a box which has a size, perpendicular size of r, and then the lateral size is actually not important here because it's of the order of system size, and it doesn't matter when you want to determine the optimal value for r. So the entropy can be estimated as log r in a hand-waving way. And if you minimize this expression, it actually tells you that that the counterion always wants to be condensed close to the surface of the macroion, because simply the electrostatic energy is linear here, and it is very strong compared to the entropy. So the moral of this is that if you have a planar macroion, actually all the counterions are condensed, and you don't see any apparent charge when you're looking at it from outside. And you have full condensation. If you do the same...
Are we in principle, it's not necessarily true when you have a system of cultural items, right? Because, you know, I could imagine sort of this power of starting from buying and then.
Okay, so let me actually, I have infinite dilution, which means I really have one membrane and just enough counterions to neutralize it. So the volume density of these counterions is zero, strictly speaking, because it only scales like surface. I will come back to the case when you have finite density. That's very important, actually. So if you have a rod which is, say, infinitely long, and the distance between two neighboring charges is A, and you have a counterion at a distance r, the same free energy is proportional to Lv and Z again, and this is the linear charge density. Okay.
For the logic of relevance, how much is this?
It's typically of the order of angstroms, so it's really a small length. Yeah. Given that Lb is of the order of, I said 7 angstrom, sigma is usually 1 charge per nanometer squared. That's the number I seem to remember. So this case is marginal because both the electrostatic energy and the entropy, which now goes like log r squared times the length in this direction, which is not important, they go logarithmically, and to minimize it and get the optimal value for R, you actually need to know the competition between these two coefficients. So it appears that we have a transition. And this value is zero, or a microscopic length scale of the order of thickness here. Let's call it delta. When the so-called Manning parameter is larger than 1, or Manning-Ozawa parameter. And it's infinity when it is less than 1. In this case, you can, since temperature is in the denominator, this is the high temperature behavior, it gains entropy, and this is the low temperature behavior. And there's this transition in between. When you have this case, and you expect some kind of charge normalization similar to the planar case, you actually, it's a little bit more delicate because when you start putting charges one by one, you actually change the effective value for A. And it doesn't go all the way to neutralize the surface. It just neutralizes or reduces the charge density to the level that you actually have an effective value for A, which is saturated at ZLV. Okay, so it's a charge renormalization, but to a fixed value, not to a value which is zero. And this is the work by Manning and Ozawa already in the 60s, and it's very interesting that they were thinking of this kind of idea at that time. Pardon? This is a mean field argument, that's true. But yes. Yes, but you can do better than that, and you always see this transition. You can do Poisson-Boltzmann theory, which I will now tell you about, and that, again, doesn't have correlations in it, etc. You can try to put some of them, and you still see this. Okay. Finally, for the case of okay, in the case of a sphere, you can guess that actually the conclusion is going to be no transition or no condensation. And the reason is simple because the electrostatic energy is like 1 over R, and you have the entropy, which is log R. And if you want to minimize it, it's actually not that obvious because the curve looks like this. Well, not exactly like this. It's a log. and it has two minima, it can take either one. But you have to take into account the fact that the sphere has a finite radius. So there's kind of an exclusion zone here. And this makes this minimum a finite minimum, whereas you still have this infinite minimum at infinity when you go and gain entropy. So there is no condensation here. Okay, I should have written it, but never mind. And the sphere is always going to have its bare charge. Now, remember that I considered only the case with infinite dilution, which means that there's only a single sphere. And you would imagine that when you have a finite density of them, you can sort of you cut off the available space to each counter ion in a sense to a distance which is set by, if you have a density, let's say C of macro ions or spheres in the solution, it's going to be cut off by a distance which is of the order of average spacing between the spheres in the solution. And in that case, you can again see that there's going to be a competition between two minima. They are now both, they have finite depth and they can compete with each other, and you can have some level of condensation depending on the density. And you can do the same thing with the rods, start putting particles one by one. This depth is going to be, okay, and this one. If this one is deeper, if the entropy one is deeper, it's going to essentially take all the counter ions, and it doesn't matter for it. The depth of the well doesn't change. If you increase the density and this distance becomes comparable or even smaller than the depth becomes smaller than the condensation one, then the particles start to actually tend to get condensed and sit on top of the sphere. But when, for example, one of them does that, the effective value for the charge is going to be reduced in the similar sense with the rod argument. So there's going to be an equilibrium when you start doing it, when the two depth, the values for the depth of the two wells is going to be equal. So I simply set this two values equal, and I can get the effective value for the charge, which tells me about how many counter ions are condensed given the density C. And that is, I call it Q star. This is known as the charge normalization formula. It's work done by Alexander, Chaikin, Grant, Morales, Finkus, and Hohn. Last author we know. They actually did it in a more civilized way than this. They simply calculated the chemical potentials and set them equal. But I was trying to give you some kind of intuition about this condensation.
First question is, does the bar screen like show up in the bar?
Okay. The Debye screening length is going to change this potential to something like this.
I mean, let me just start off with this question. I would like to say that the radius of the sphere is large as compared to the Debye screening length, and I feel like the difference between the membrane and the...
That's true. But then, in that case, the potential is actually going to be only linear within the Debye screening length. So in that case, you don't expect actually full condensation if the Debye screening length is that small. Okay.
But you don't have any cushion.
Yeah. Because if there's finite density of ions, the finite density of counter ions would do something like salt for me. So there's going to be a screening by this density, but then I can argue that given the distances that I'm worrying about, if okay, can I actually say that the screening length? I think it's not trivial that the screening length and this length, they are the same, so, or that one is going to be larger than this. There's going to be because this one scales like minus one half power of the density, and this one scales like minus one third. So I need to match it with Beerom length, and I guess because Beerom length is such a small length, it means that this one is going to be larger when I start from very small densities. Okay, it's different because even if you forget about this case, even if I don't have any salt, even if I have just one rod, say, and just a number of counter ions, which is linear in my thermodynamically large length scale, I'm going to see this effect, whereas screening length is infinite, and in that case, I don't see any. There's no, the cloud that you have in mind, which whenever there is a particle, there is this Debye-Huckel cloud around it, which has this size of kappa inverse, is different than this. Okay. Yeah, we are looking at the case when this length actually is very large, is infinite.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, this is my fourth column. If you prefer more physical arguments than this one, like Ilya, okay, this is, I guess.
You know, I mean, in Landau Institute, it used to be the case when somebody started to talk to UFO and would not write something.
Some equations, okay.
Larkin, Antonio Ivanovich, would say, Hamiltonian does have the form.
Okay. Yeah, I reserve this for this particular audience. I was sure this would be brought up. Yeah. Okay, so this is the so-called Poisson-Boltzmann equation. It's a mean field approximation in the sense that you have the density of, I'm using a reduced dimension in which phi is dimensionless. It's actually E times electrostatic potential divided by KT. The Poisson's law simply says that Laplacian of phi should be the total charge density. Now, if you have some external charge density, like the density of surfaces and colloidal particles, and some counter ions, I only chose positively charged ones, you expect to have this, and here I have replaced a Boltzmann weight for the density, assuming that the particles are locally in equilibrium with the external environment, and the only energy scale for them to actually use when they want to construct their Boltzmann weights is the electrostatic energy, given they are present at that point with that particular value for the potential. And you can actually show that this is a mean field theory by doing a better job. You can write down the partition function of the system of charges like a Stein-Gordon field theory if you want. It's going to be like this, plus a term which is a coupling between external density and the potential. This is all okay. Now, if you take the saddle point of this equation, you get this Poisson-Boltzmann result, and you can see why it's the mean field theory. And of course, you can do better than that. You can calculate the corrections on top of saddle point. And that's the next thing I'm going to talk about. Okay. Actually, let me... No, I prefer to do something before that. Okay. So, now we know what the counter ions are doing, whether they want to be close to the macro ions or they want to go away. We want to see what is the effect of this condensation phenomena on the interaction between two of these macro ions. Let's start with the case of charged plates and try to calculate the interaction between them given that there is this full condensation. Full condensation means you have essentially all the positive charges for this one here and all the positive charges for this one here. The interaction between them, which can be constructed from the free energy of this configuration, is going to be proportional to LB. You have sigma squared, and you have R. This would be the interaction if you didn't have any screening effect. It's proportional to both. Actually, I need a surface area here. If you didn't have any of this condensation, it's just a constant electric field, and you get this form for the interaction. But because of the condensation, I actually have two double layers here, and there's this thickness, I can call it lambda, which I just calculated. So what I have to do is, in fact, take two derivatives with respect to R and multiply it by lambda squared to get the value for potential. And we all know that when we take two derivatives of a linear function, it doesn't give zero, it gives 1 over r. And you multiply it by lambda squared, you actually get rid of these two sigmas, and you get z squared here, lb here. I guess that's it. Let's try to do it for this case. I was trying to cook up some argument to give you this pi by 2, but I really couldn't. Yeah, I admit that. So let's have these rods here. Again, the interaction is going to be proportional to LB, to the length. And you need the effective charge density squared here. In the case that A is less than ZLB, you don't have condensation, so it's not actually very interesting. You're interested in the case that you do have condensation, and in that case, you get this 1 over ZLB squared for the charge density. Remember, A was renormalized to ZLB. So you again get something like this. And of course, the form of the interaction is log R. And for this case, what I need to do is essentially use Q star squared here, which you can see that it's going to give me similar result, except that I have these log It's repulsion for all the three cases. Which one is attraction? This one? I guess you go to small. Okay, probably I have to put a minus sign here. No? Sorry, I want to. The derivative is 1 over r. It's sort of. Okay. Pardon? Yeah. All of them are repulsive, I guess. Yeah. Sorry?
right? Pretty long. It could be a little hard, spotted by the...
Yeah, I need a cutoff here. But I still need a minus sign. That was, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of a conceptual question.
Mm-hmm.
We're supposed to be thinking of systems where we haven't added any additional ions to the strain.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, in that case, I would imagine typically I'm thinking of some finite density, maybe polymers or whatever.
Yes. So I. Okay. So you're saying what is the infinite dilution in terms of, I mean,
the physical limit, I mean the lower limit on the concentration of ions is compensating the charges on your optic.
Okay, you need to not see the other one. So this distance has to be large compared to, say, you have, essentially what it limits is not the, primarily when it starts to have limiting effects is on the entropy, not on the energy. Because the screening it provides for the electrostatic energy when you start to add, you know, a few rods in the solution, it's not really that important. And what I'm trying to say is that, okay, you may say that, for example, I guess you're asking for a quantitative, say, inequality or something like that. You know, what may be confusing is that there are different time, different length scales. I was thinking about it. So this one is essentially going to go like c to the minus 1/2, but then there's going to be another length here, because the number of counterions is the number of macroions times area or length, for example, in this case, length. So I'm going to have something like this here. I guess this is... So you need to compare... I'm trying to estimate the number of counterions that a finite density of, say, rods introduce in the solution. And you need to compare that with the... That gives you a screening length, and then you have another length which limits the... The screening length limits the energy, limits the electrostatic Coulomb. This is the tail of the energy. And this one limits the entropy.
You've been assuming...
Yes.
So, I guess you can achieve that in some region of concentration. But even assuming that, why or when are the interactions really two-body interactions generated?
Okay, two-body interaction is when two of them actually get very close to each other and the other ones are far apart. So, I think you don't really worry about that one. As long as, let's say, eventually, this thing is going to have a length, and if that length is smaller than the length of separation, you don't really need to worry about that effect. I mean, okay. So you have a rod here, and a rod here. And if the rods are really like this, this one is not going to affect, in a many-body way, the interaction between them. As long as you can think about a multiple expansion, as long as this length is smaller than this. Of course, in experiments, the situation is much more complicated. And that was why I was trying to avoid, you know, having the experimental approach to the problem, because you never get such a infinitely dilute system, for example, in experiment. You always have a lot of them, and the finite density introduces a lot of complications. And for example, the counter ions are condensed, but that's because you squeeze them, not because they want to. If they were, for example, you know, if you had this infinite dilution. And then the other effect, which I'm going to talk about now, which is the fluctuations, again, is going to be affected by the fact that you have a large number of these macro ions close to each other. And that's a different, I sort of see it as a more complicated version of the same thing, which you can always try to see these effects when you narrow your picture to down to one of them. But I chose this infinite dilution approach to simply account for the physics, you know, not worrying about all the complications.
Yeah. At the moment, we're still repelling.
At the moment, you're still repelling, so I didn't expect this many. Yeah.
Perhaps we could get on with the talk rather than that.
Okay. So, now we have this cloud of counter ions close to the macro ions, and of course at room temperature you expect the macro ion plus the cloud of counter ions to be highly polarizable, and you expect it to undergo thermal fluctuations. All kinds of multiples can be excited due to thermal motion, thermal excitations. And from van der Waals interaction, for example, we know that if we have, say, dipoles or multiples that are fluctuating, there's going to be an attraction between the two objects. In traditional van der Waals interaction, it's quantum fluctuations, but it doesn't really matter. If you have thermal fluctuation, it's going to have the same effect. So, or for example, you may be more familiar with the so-called Casimir effect, which is when you have two metallic plates and you have vacuum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field. And because these conductors have this boundary condition that they can't tolerate lateral electric field, they are ready to undergo any kind of polarization to vanish or have vanished the value of lateral or tangential electric field. When you have all these fluctuations in between, that is going to induce some kind of attraction between the two plates. And you can see the similar pattern here. You have these the cloud of counter ions here, and they are ready to fluctuate to, if you impose any electric field, for example, parallel to the surface of the plates, they are ready to fluctuate and to eliminate that. So I'm trying, okay, given the picture, let me try to actually estimate the missing terms here for the interaction. For the case of two plates, the attractive force is going to be, again, extensive. It's going to be proportional to area. It should have a minus sign because these kind of fluctuation in these interactions usually are attractive, and the reason for that is they put restrictions on the fluctuations, so the fluctuating field wants to put them together to eliminate, to get rid of the restriction they are putting. And that is a very loose way of saying, of arguing why they should be attractive. And because they are more or less, there is no length scale in the problem that can be attributed to these fluctuations here, you expect to make a dimensionless free energy, you expect 2 powers of R here, which is very similar to the Casimir force, except that there is one, okay, in this case, it's 1 over R cubed, and the reason for that is that the interaction energy times T, or the action, should be extensive in both time and area. And that's why you have 3 powers of R. And there's an H bar because it is always proportional to the characteristics of the fluctuations. And in this case, it's KT because that's what drives the fluctuations, and you have it here. Let's try to do the same thing for the rods. Again, it's going to be attractive. It's going to be extensive, proportional to the length. And you can put 1 power of r here to make it dimensionless. And of course, there are numerical prefactors, which often they are the most interesting part or non-trivial part of Casimir force calculations, but we neglect it for the moment. Yes.
Wrong sign.
Okay. That is a very tricky issue about the spherical. So what David is alluding to is the example of a spherical conductor, let's say, of radius A, and it has a Casimir energy, which is like, okay, let me get the sign right this time. It wants to repel in the sense that it is happier when the radius is larger. I guess this is the correct sign. And the way people do away with that is they say if you increase A, you actually, and you want to maintain the zero boundary condition, you actually add some matter because you're going to have a radius of larger, a sphere of larger radius, say A plus delta A, and you have, brought a little, some amount of matter here from infinity or whatever, and that changes the boundary condition somehow you're imposing. No, because when you change the distance between the plates, you actually maintain the integrity, you respect it. No, you add vacuum. No, to calculate the surface of this, the area of this conducting sphere, you get a larger, you need matter here, and that's what confuses people. It's not a definitive argument, but at least it's something to, I don't know, I'm not happy with it. And if you actually cut the sphere into two parts and do this, they would attract each other. Yeah, so... Okay. So the kind of boundary condition they impose is one-dimensional. In that case, it was two-dimensional, and you expected an energy which goes like surface area, and here it goes like linear. So if you are I don't know. It just does as much as it can. I don't think any problem with that. If you do the calculation, you certainly get the result this way. Okay. Finally, for the case of spheres, it is actually more in the spirit of van der Waals interaction, which is what we are more familiar or comfortable with. You have these two objects, they have fluctuating multiples, and you want to estimate the interaction between them. If you had fluctuating dipoles, like the case of van der Waals interaction, you would write something like a dipole-dipole interaction and run your quantum mechanical perturbation theory, and this one is going to be zero. The first non-zero term is going to be this one, and that's why you get this 1 over R6, which is the famous van der Waals interaction. Now, in this case, you have thermal fluctuations, and there's another difference which is very important, and that's the first non-vanishing multiple which is fluctuating is actually charge. It's monopole, not the dipole interaction. Because these spheres are in contact with the solvent, and they can exchange particles. In a sense, you have grounded, if you wish, these two spheres or metallic spheres. And if you calculate the interaction between them, given that they can actually have fluctuating monopoles, the interaction is going to be monopole, monopole interaction squared averaged, which is like a 1 over r squared with a negative sign. And, oh, I forgot to put this necessary b squared here from the, I guess this a is also b. Because I was using this formula, this charge normalization formula, which I erased. And here you can actually convince yourself that the length scale you need to make it dimensionless is the radius. And you can work it out in the calculation. If it was the dipole fluctuations, it would be the whole volume of the sphere, because that's the object that has, it's like the polarizability, it has the dimensions right, but here you're doing it with multiples. So if you look at all these three formulas, you see that there is this short length scale, which is of the order of z squared lb, if you forget about the coefficients and all these logs and all these marginal dependencies. And this interaction, which comes from the fluctuations, if it can dominate the repulsion, the residual repulsion, it could be only at length scales smaller than this. And of course, Biram length is only 7 angstrom, so you would be on the verge of disappointment, because it's a very short length scale. And the only good point or good news is that you have this valence to play around with, and that's something which actually has been seen frequently in the experiments, that once you replace, say, monovalent counterions with divalent or trivalent, you get much better, the attraction is actually much more important, and you have a better chance of dominance of the attraction. Yes, you can see in these almost all of them. Yeah, so
they have 10 charges. They try to screen and they overscreen.
Yes. So when they fluctuate, they do it, all they know when they fluctuate is from entropy. So they get a kick and they jump up and down. But they carry all these big charges with them when they do this. Yeah. So they sort of tend to increase. Although you don't see it here, because the Casimir correction is actually independent of Z, and it's only the repulsion which is reduced by Z. But it's effectively the same thing.
Can you describe your problem as some kind of interaction of these charges in some effective media described by some dielectric constant, that's not clear for me? Or is it impossible to do
that? It's not impossible to do that. Actually, it's a very interesting...
Would you be actually something like what solid-state people call local field correction, which is exception to
That's
because
true.
I suspect that if you would be able to describe it only as epsilon chaotic, then you can never overscreen. You know it for, by example, of say superconductivity, that only
I
by
see.
Making use of this interpretation you can really overscreen. Otherwise, you can't. You don't have any interpretation. So what's actually different? Why? Like
okay. One thing I.
Whereas we cannot normal method.
That's a good point. One thing that I can think of is the fact that I don't have any screening here, so my interactions are actually non-analytic. That's true. I have screening in a non-analytic way. That's true, but when I, for example, write my propagator is not like k squared plus kappa squared. I don't have analytic version of screening here. I have some kind of non-analytic. If you want to define something like a screening length, for example, here, it's going to be very tricky, because the form of the potential is actually changing.
For instance, if I would try to describe the direction of these two spheres, like painting them as like a particle, then you say that your direction is not really only a function of transverse momentum, but also function of total momentum, or what?
Suppose
I treat them as ordinary charges, particles, point-blank charges. Would you kind of take me?
Okay, I would say maybe it's it has a non-analytic dependence on Q. That's the simplest I can imagine. Explanation. I mean, maybe it's not a full explanation. I haven't actually thought about it that way because I only have two particles here. I have to construct a medium and do something like an use something like a translational invariance. But simply from the statement that the form of the potential is actually changing non-analytically, it gives a sense of okay, I guess I just wanted to use this Fine-Gordon field theory to show the dependence on the to show the relation that I use the analogy to Casimir effect. It's actually not. How much time do I have, David?
5-10 minutes,
okay. So you simply want to construct the fluctuations on the saddle point, and it has this form. There's this saddle point part of the free energy times this fluctuation. The saddle point part of the free energy gives you the result of the full Poisson-Boltzmann calculation, and it's always repulsive. Actually, there are theorems now around proven by mathematicians for different kind of boundary conditions which tell you that between like charges, you always get a repulsion within Poisson-Boltzmann. This effective mass that you get here for the fluctuations, which is space dependent, is actually given by the same formula, but you replace the density by the space-dependent density, which is, okay, nothing but the Poisson-Boltzmann solution for the potential. And you know it from the arguments that I gave you here, that this density is going to be peaked close to the counter, close to the macro ion. It's going to be very small in the bulk everywhere else. So you can think about the density, for example, to have a form like this because of the condensation. So if you look at the fluctuations of your field, it's going to be massive when you approach a macro ion, and it's going to be free everywhere else. And being massive means the fluctuations is constrained when you approach the macro ion. So in this sense, you can see the relation to the Casimir effect because the fluctuations in your field is only reduced or diminished when you approach this boundary condition. And this way, you can actually do a very good job in terms of these calculations and work out all the coefficients, etc. Yes, so the saddle point equation is Poisson-Boltzmann for the imaginary, purely imaginary field, and then you construct fluctuations on that. No, it doesn't. Your phi is going to be, say, I phi bar plus the delta phi. Delta phi is real. This one is purely imaginary. Yes.
So, there's some limit here where the mass goes to infinity and the thing which is a boundary value problem is zero by boundary.
Yes, so you to get this simple formula, what you do essentially, you can't really work out the density profile to the detail, so you approximate it by some kind of step function or delta function, which is more or less a good approximation when you have highly charged particles. For a highly charged surface, if you calculate the density, it actually looks pretty much like a delta function, which is peaked at the... So this way, if you put delta function here, it's exactly Casimir force then. Okay. I guess I want to show you. Couple of transparencies before your patience is exhausted. To actually put this calculation to a very this attractive interaction to a very stringent test, you can ask the question of whether this attraction is actually able to overcome, in addition to the repulsion, to overcome the mechanical stiffness of individual particle polymers, because it is seen in, observed in experiments that, for example, DNA molecules actually condense or collapse by themselves when the other guys are not around. So in this case, you can actually you actually expect the attractive interaction to overcome both the Coulomb repulsion, which is already very difficult, and the short scale stiffness, mechanical stiffness of the polymer. And because the interaction was only good at short length scales, it's not a trivial question to ask, because maybe when it becomes sufficiently strong, it is actually cut off by the other interaction. So here is a calculation, you can call it a phase diagram, for a polymer which has a persistence length LP, which is essentially the length at which the mechanical stiffness of the polymer can resist thermal fluctuations, and divided by this A, which is the distance between two charges. And here you have the length of the polymer divided by this same length scale. It appears that this attraction can do the collapse of the polymer, can achieve it only if the persistence length is less than a critical value, which in this case you can actually see is pretty small by these numbers here. But it increases with the valence. For example, this is for z equals 4. If you choose a higher value for z, it is actually going to be much better. And below that value for critical persistence length, actually the polymer can have two different phases. It can have either a necklace phase or a collapse phase, depending on whether the longest length scale deformation mode for the polymer is stable or unstable. In this case, it's unstable. In this case, the instability is only in the intermediate wavelengths of the deformation mode. But the longest length scale is still, there's some kind of a competition here. It's still stable, so you get something like a necklace phase, which is locally collapsed, but not on the larger length scale. If you add salt, it's going to be much easier, because of course the interaction is screened and it's not a big deal anymore to overcome. You can see that the numbers have improved here for the persistence length. Actually, if DNA is somewhere here, it has this persistence length of 500 angstroms, and A for DNA is 1.7 angstrom. And you can see that it suggests that for DNA you can collapse it with Z equals 3, which is actually the case in experiment. And here is the screening length that I have replaced by, that I have used instead of the length of the polymer, because now Coulomb interaction is cut off by this length. Here is a picture of how these condensates or collapsed structures of, in this case, actin, not DNA, look like. The reason it's possible, the reason it's nicer for actin is that the persistence length actually for actin is so large that you can actually see them, for example, using fluorescence microscopy in this case. So these are bundles formed out of DNA, out of actin. When they introduce multivalent counterions, they start to wrap around, and this typical length scale, which is the minimal length here, is set by the mechanical stiffness. You can't really collapse it to length scales lower than that. What they observed, which was a very interesting feature, was that as soon as you start to have two turns or more of the actin in the condensate, the structure appears to develop these sharp corners, like here, and here, and to have something like a kink rod structure instead of the smooth curve which you expect when you have a stiff object, for example, a semi-flexible polymer, as it is called, or a stiff polymer, it has this random walk type behavior. And it's not very difficult to explain this. This is actually can be attributed to the anisotropy in the stiffness of the structure as they saw it. It appears that when you have a, say, stiff ribbon which has some anisotropy, it is easier to bend it in this way, but it's not easy to bend it in this way. This constraint actually makes twist and bend in the structure mutually exclusive, in the sense that if you have a twist at some local region of it, you can't have bend at the same time, because that would require a component from the forbidden type of bending. So what it does, it actually concentrates all the bends in very sharp turns and then develops the relatively long straight rod-like sections in which it can gain the entropy from twist conformations. And if you compare the overall entropy of this configuration for its for this ribbon-like structure to the smooth curve, it's going to have higher entropy. So it's actually temperature effect plus some frustration which would lead to this ordered kind of, okay, structure, this sharp corners which you don't expect them in a purely entropic system. I guess I can stop here.
Thank you.
Yes.
So if I consider the points on both my questions as a saddle point, I'll get exactly the divided equation for free entropy.
If you linearize it, you need to linearize it. Yeah. And usually this kind of condensation phenomenon takes place when the counter ions are very close to the surface and you have a high value for the potential field. So linearization is actually not a good approximation in this case. It depends on the density. It can be small, can be large.
But the fact that you have ions directly on the surface, I would say, is a limiting case of the devices where it's
just... Okay, if you want to think about this, if you want to use this space-dependent device screening length, in that case you can say, okay, when I'm close to the surface, because there is condensation, rho x becomes very large, and locally device screening length is very large. But in the bulk, it's going to be very small because all the counter ions are close to the surface. Yes?
This is an example where nature relaxes mechanisms and attraction, and repulsion to attraction. You know, are there other cases where it actually wants repulsion and uses that?
Okay, I guess you mean specifically for an application, I can't imagine now, but there's this famous example of cell fusion. Whenever there is a vesicle or something like a spherical object which has some material in it which is supposed to deliver it to the cell, of course when it moves about, it can't deliver it to the first cell that it sees. So that's why the outer surface, both are negatively charged and they repel each other. But as soon as it hits the target, which is supposed to deliver, there are some little proteins on the surface. They usually do the recognition. So they recognize that, okay, this is the surface that I, this is the object that I'm supposed to deliver my stuff in. And then there is going to be, then there are some local ion channels and they locally release some highly, some multivalent counter ions of valence 3 and 4. And then locally there's going to be this attraction. You know, it sets in and they fuse because of the attraction, and then it opens up upon fusion because this cell surface is made out of lipids, and it's a two-dimensional surface but made out of individual molecules. It can open up.
So even
it doesn't open up at the channel. The channel is a very small protein, and it's right here, and it only, you know, releases. It acts like a little, it like injection or something. I don't know. It's like a little needle. It's not really that large scale. But then the surface itself, if you blow this structure here, it has these. It is formed of these lipid bilayers, and they have these polar heads and these tails that are nonpolar. They are. It's called hydrophobic here, and it's called hydrophilic here. This guy likes water. This guy hates water. Then two of them come close together, and they hit. There's going to be a small hole opens up here, and then the interior of these actually both hate water, so they like each other, and they start to attract each other, and the topology changes locally, if you wish. There's going to be a neck here, and genus changes, whatever. Knows how to replace monovalent by multivalent when it's necessary, yeah.
Maybe a question at the very beginning, going back. Your net system, is it electron neutral?
It is neutral. It is neutral. Actually, that's necessary because otherwise you have this huge repulsion due to...
Maybe, say, for instance, one charge on one... rod and another charge on another rod, and maybe out of 100 charges, 99 are compensated, but you...
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand that. That's why I started by saying that this usually ends up being a little bit disappointing, because you start with, you know, this idea that you're going to see two like charges in vacuum attracting each other, but it's not like that. There's all these...
Finally, they are neutral objects.
Yeah, finally they are neutral objects, but there's a little bit of displacement, and that's very delicate. Yeah. For example, in the canonical example of two plates, you actually don't have any charges left. You have full condensation. You see neutral objects attracting each other, no big deal. Dipoles, okay. Yeah. It's not true that only thermodynamic fluctuations. There are correlation effects which I didn't mention just for time reasons. There's this issue of, for example, Wigner crystal or Wigner liquid formation of the counterions on the surface. If you have this uniformly negatively charged surface, you have the positive ions with valence Z. They tend to form some kind of a correlated structure, and if you bring two of them together, they may anti-correlate in displacement so that actually the plus sees the minus, the shortest distance. And this can happen when they are very close to each other. Because at room temperature, you don't expect a Wigner crystal to actually hold. Yeah, so I try to estimate more or less the fluctuation contribution, and this other contribution is a little bit more tricky, but you can actually try to estimate that one. And if you compare them, they are actually in place, they're in duty when the macroions are very, very close to together. Because, for example, in this case, in 1D, you don't have a Wigner crystal. When they are very close to each other, you have little patches, which is essentially of the size of your correlation length, and they can correlate with each other in the out-of-phase way, and they contribute to the attraction, and the force is short range, it's exponentially decaying, whereas in this case you have long range decay, okay, at least a little bit long range, still shorter range than repulsion, but at least algebraic. And in the case of collapse of a polymer, I guess everybody now agrees that those kinds of correlated induced, the short range version cannot trigger anything like collapse, because it requires, you know, a lot of repulsion you need to overcome, and there needs to be some kind of long range interaction involved. You mean two bare charged surfaces with no counter ions in it.
So the counter ions are not the condensers.
No, but counter ions have to be condensed because that's their energetically favorable state.
But there's a difference when you're very light.
Yeah, that's true. So you're saying when this lambda is like this, when this is lambda, there can still be attraction. I'm not sure in that case because repulsion is going to be, there's going to be some charge left to see and, yeah, please.
When you calculate solvation forces within plates with some liquid, with some structure in it, the liquid has its structure and their neutral, things like that, you very frequently end up with oscillatory.
That's true. The contribution that I calculated is monotonic, but you do see there are other contributions. You do see all these structures, the oscillatory correlations, for example. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you get opposite charges to repel?
Not with this scenario because this. As I mentioned, the fluctuations always leads to attraction because it's not, I mean, it's this average of something squared. It always reduces the energy. But using other kinds of separation of charges, people have seen repulsion between like charges, unlike charges, yeah. Yes?
Does this phenomenon play an important role in protein folding?
In the case of protein folding, the major driving force is the fact that protein, again, when it folds, it has this structure which is hydrophobic inside. So inside hates water and outside likes water. So when it's in the form of a polymer, of a polypeptide, it has these forms that hate water and they actually bear. So there's this huge force by the surrounding water which very quickly wants to collapse this. Electrostatic is not really that important. Although essentially, at the end of the day, you're going to have these charges outside. And you may have, okay, two of them interact somehow funny due to the electrostatics, but not in the collapsing pathway.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just a note? No, I don't think so. Just a page.